Hello, readers, and welcome to READ, the Research Education Advocacy Podcast. READ connects you with researchers, educators, and thought leaders on topics in education and child development. READ is produced by the Winward Institute. I'm your host, Dr. Danielle Gomez, and in this episode, I invited Dr. Nina Saha for a conversation on translation to educational practice. In fact, Dr. Saha and I talked about not only translation, but implications for systems and the role of technology in social media. Trust me, I learned so much. And in fact, I had a lot of questions for Dr. Saha. So for those of you tuning in on YouTube, you may notice some outfit changes. And no, we did not change our outfit mid-conversation. We actually recorded across two time periods. So I want to thank Dr. Saha for offering your time. It was so generous to record this over a couple of days. And for those of you listening, you may hear some differences in audio, but no worries at all. That is just communicating my curiosity. So I invite you to be just as curious and to take some notes and learn along with me in this episode. I'll see you after the episode, readers. I am eager to introduce our guest for this month's episode, Dr. Nina Saha. Dr. Saha, welcome to the READ podcast.
Hi, thank you guys for having me. I'm honored to be here.
Thank you. We are so happy to have you. I'm personally so happy to have you because there's so much that I want to talk to you about and learn from you. I'd like to know first, where are you in the world and how are you showing up to this conversation?
Well, I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. Technically, I'm in Cary. So if you're familiar with the area, it's just a little bit west of Raleigh. And right now I'm consulting for a bunch of different companies and thinking about better ways to bridge this research to practice gap that we'll get into. So that's kind of how I'm showing up right now.
I love that. Thank you for sharing that. And when I first learned about your work, I've seen a number of things that you have posted online for us as educators to learn from you and learn from the research. I was so lucky to see you in person a few months ago at the Reading League conference, and it spawned so many thoughts and questions. And what I admire most about you is that I see you as a social entrepreneur in education, particularly in finding innovative methods to translate research to practice. And so I'm excited for our READ listeners to learn more about you. For those of you just learning about Dr. Saha, I'm going to READ her formal bio and then we'll dive into the conversation. How does that sound?
Yeah, that sounds great. Yeah.
Great. So Dr. Saha began her career in education as a classroom teacher for children with exceptional needs. She received her master's degree in educational neuroscience from Columbia University and her PhD in special education from Vanderbilt's Peabody College. Dr. Saha's doctoral work resulted in a patent. And you can also READ a number of her journal articles and her work through various journals and publications. While at LMNO?
Yeah, LMNO. You got it wrong.
I love that. Yeah. No, that's exactly what I thought about. But then I think when I was overthinking, I don't know, saying it. But anyways, LMNO, love it, LMNO. She started in the Reading Research Recap. Another example of how innovative you are. Okay, so the Reading Research Recap, a newsletter aimed at translating recent research into useful information for teachers. LMNO was acquired by Metametrics in 2021 and joined her team to help build out their early literacy products, tools, and services. Dr. Saha left Metametrics full-time, she still consults, in 2023 and explores better ways of translating research at scale. Ooh, so there's so much to dive into that. So I always like to first ask, after reading the bio, about your story. I consider myself a connector of science and story. So tell us more about your story and your professional journey through this translation of research at scale.
Of course. And I just want to say that bio makes it seem super impressive what I've done. And even when you use the term social entrepreneur, like, I never set out to do that. So it's kind of interesting to think about it from that perspective. For me, it was just about solving problems. And these were the skills I had at the time. And these were the problems I was noticing that I could apply my skills to and fix. And I think that's something like, just even in my personality, you know, there's people who are like really good at like listening when someone has a problem or like doing. And for me, my first impulse is, let's just build it. Let's just do it. Let's take some action. And so I even have to, like, when I'm talking to people, be like, wait, do you just need a listener now? Or do you need a problem solver? Because I'm the problem solver. So anyways, back to the bio. It seems super impressive, but I want people to know, and I think this is an important thing I haven't said in other podcasts or talks, that it that makes it sound like everything was super easy. And so for people starting out who want to go on this path, just know that there's a lot of failures, a lot of things that didn't work. And this was like a tough process. And we can talk about that part too, because I think that's really cool. There was this one researcher once who created a CV of failures. And like, I thought that was so neat because you often only see like these like 60 page long CVs of researchers. And it's like, oh my God, they've done all this. I can never be that person. And it's overwhelming. But I think it's just important to acknowledge that, you know, there's failures along the way. So just for people at home or, you know, listeners who are trying to aspire to do something like this as well. So one of my first jobs after college was teaching, and I taught 9th and 10th graders in a school that serves special education children, so high needs. Then these 9th and 10th graders basically given up on reading. They'd been passed along, but they still couldn't, they hadn't mastered basic decoding skills of multisyllabic words. So we're really struggling with fluent reading. And I kind of cringe when I talk about this because I realize how unprepared I was at the time. I shouldn't have been doing it. Like, I know why California had a credentialing system. It's called an emergency credential, where you can start teaching as you're getting credentialed. But that means is that when you're starting, you don't have the right credentials to teach. So, and I think a lot of teachers, though, can empathize with that because, you know, as they learn more through the science of reading, they're also, you know, oh my gosh, some of these practices I was doing, you know, wasn't evidence-based or research-backed, and then you have this shame and guilt. So that aside, I just want to say I was in that place too of like, am I doing the right thing? Luckily, we had a principal at the school who was aware kind of there's, you know, intensive, systematic phonics instruction being an important need for students. And so she trained me and another teacher. We got trained in the Wilson program, which is, you know, systematic, intensive phonics instruction, which was great. We delivered it with fidelity. Some of the students did well, some still didn't. And at the time, I didn't know about, you know, that you really, some students need just a lot more repetition and practice. Mm-hmm. And, but I took that opportunity. I was like, well, this is really interesting. I'd always had a science background to go back to school and figure out, you know, like, what do we know? What does the science say? Because I remember in some of my credentialing courses, and I cringe even when I talk about this because it's like we were writing the reading course that we were taught how to teach students to read. And one of my papers, I think I still have it, where I talk about creating cozy reading nooks in the classroom. I'm like, that's great. But yeah, where's the evidence back? Where's the science stuff? Where are we talking about that? You know? Mm-hmm. So anyways, fast forward. And here's the part that actually, you know, it was hard for me because I'll admit this to the public. I'm finally in a space comfortable to do this, that my, you know, I goofed off a little bit, partied too hard in my undergrad. My GPA was not great. So it was really hard for me actually to get back into grad school. I couldn't just apply to grad schools. And in the field of medicine, they have like post-bac programs where you can like take some courses, increase your GPA, then get into med school. So I looked for the equivalent for psychology or like cognitive psychology programs. And there were great ones at Columbia. I think UPenn had one, but my GPA was even kind of like too low for those. And I was past the deadlines, but I reached out to a person at Columbia and she's like, just send me your resume. Let's see what you have. And as if to add insult to injury, she was like, well, even though you're past the deadline, I'm like, I wouldn't admit you anyways because your GPA is too low. And I was like crushed. But there's this one line at the end of the email. And she's like, well, if you apply to the continuing ed school, basically anyone can get into that and take the courses that you would have taken in the post-bac. And if you get all A's in those, I'll let you in. I was like, okay, well, this is like my last hope.
Yeah.
So I do that. And I moved to Manhattan from California and a fifth story walk up close to Teachers College in Harlem. And I did that. I just, you know, I got the stats book like the summer before and overprepared. I was so nervous for that first stats exam, but, you know, I worked really hard and got those A's and then got into the post-bac program, got into the grad school program there in educational neuroscience, fast forward to the PhD program at Vanderbilt. So long story, but I just want to tell people it wasn't super, you know, just stick with it. And like, it wasn't super easy. And I feel like people always make it sound like it's so easy. And I did this and then I did this, but people who are going through it know that it's actually really not. So
yeah, it's never a linear path, right?
Yeah.
And so much of what you share too, I think echoes a little bit of where my story, and without getting into it, but I do think that there's this interesting nuance of even some of those missteps or even just the pivots lead you to where you are and where you kind of your purpose is. And I think, again, going back to your teaching roles, I also share a similar story of where's the evidence to help my students that are struggling. Even in a previous episode, when I was talking with Dr. Amy Elliman, she also shared a similar story as well of how do I help my students who are struggling? And so perhaps that was the moment where you thought about the research to practice gap, but where did you sort of, where was that path where you said, oh, wow, you know, there is a gap, or perhaps there's a better way to translate research to the hands of teachers. Where in that journey did you see that?
Yeah, well, I really started to see that in my doc program at Vanderbilt. So my master's program was in educational neuroscience, but I learned pretty quickly while I was at Vanderbilt that there weren't direct classroom implications. And I had gotten into this. My motivation for, you know, going back to school was like kind of figuring out what we do know. Why was there this subset of kids that even with intensive phonics instruction was still not making, you know, adequate progress?
Right.
And I thought, all right, well, let's learn about the brain to figure out what we can do. But like I just said, educational neuroscience still, like, you don't, there aren't those direct practical implications. And so in my program at Vanderbilt, I really focused more on behavioral. And here that means like the behavior of kids, like reading out loud, analyzing their errors, you know, figuring out like how to help kids learn to decode, acquire the code. So that early stage of learning to read. And that's when I realized that all these researchers knew something that teachers didn't. That it was like well known that systematic phonics instruction, and I learned that through the literature, but also through my courses and just talking to everyone at Vanderbilt knew this, yet none of the teachers I had worked with or my teacher, the professors and the teacher prep programs I had attended were telling me this. So I'm like, here's a massive gap. Yeah. And so that was really eye-opening. And then there is another incident, is not an incident, actually a joyful occasion, was the birth of my son, and he had language delays. And so I was kind of struggling to figure out what are the evidence-based practices that I can use at home for him? Like, what should I be doing? And we eventually, you know, found the right solution and got him the help he needed. But it was still like this moment of, there's not an easy way to access. There's not a good bridge between that information for the people who need it.
Right.
And so, you know, that's when I realized there's this problem that I think a lot of people realize now too. And that, you know, Emily Hanford and Sold a Story is kind of elucidated in such a great way. I think it's kind of interesting that like researchers knew this forever, and yet it took a great storyteller in a way to get that information out there in the public. So I think that's something that researchers should think about in how we message and package information too.
Yeah. Well, I think I appreciate you saying that, because I think over the last year, that's where I came into this identity as a connector of science and story. And I also see that as you as well, of using tools that bridge the science and tell the story in a way that resonate with teachers. That's why I think things like in professional development, seeing models or seeing case studies of students who struggle, it sort of says, oh, right. Like a teacher can say, yeah, me too. Like I see that as well in my classroom. And so even vehicles like podcasting, or when you did the Metametrics research roundup, like those are the things that I think ground kind of provides like this human aspect, right? Of not necessarily operationalizing research concepts, but humanizing in the way that makes sense in the classroom. And I do want to talk about your work at LMNO and Metametrics and some of the things that you have done to innovate this and connect science and story. But let's even think just globally about this research to practice gap. And on READ and in my own professional work, actually, even in my doctorate work, I focus a lot on improvement science. So it's taking the needs assessment, identifying a problem of practice, and researching different types of interventions and testing them and seeing what happens and collecting data in your context. I see similarities with implementation science, particularly being increasingly adopted in education sciences to ultimately provide educational interventions, not even interventions, but programs and practices that are ultimately going to best serve students and teachers at scale. And so I see some movement in that area. But for you, how would you evaluate this current state of research to practice? Like, what is going well in terms of maybe some facilitators, and what might be some barriers that are contributing to this persistent gap?
Yes. So I have a lot of thoughts on that, but I'm going to be annoying and go back to something real quick you said about, first of all, I love the phrase connecting science and story. I think that's really great. And you used the word interface, and I've been thinking about that a lot. Like, how do we interface with research? And I came across this great, I forget if it was a blog or a video, about how Steve Jobs was talking about how people interface with something as scary as like a desktop computer. And to show that it wasn't scary, I think there's a commercial or something and they had a handle on it and he threw it out the window, right? So smartphones had been around for a while, but Apple changed the way people interface with it, right? That intuitive design. And so that's something I've been thinking a lot about with something as scary as like a complex research paper. Mm-hmm. Think about the vocab, the stats, like everything in it. It's like, I don't want to read that. Just right. How do we fix that interface? And I think there's a lot of interesting things we can do there. So that's what I wanted to say about that. But yeah. Barriers to access implementation science, what are things that are going well? So I'm going to be a little bit, because this is just who I am and my personality. I don't think it's going well. I think it's going pretty badly in terms of bridging the research to practice gap. And I think Solda's story really highlighted that this is an important point. It's not just teachers who are not getting the information. It's also product developers and curriculum designers. Mm-hmm. And they were hopefully trying to do good. I don't think it was like on purpose. I think some people would argue with that statement. But in my mind, it's like, I think if they had the knowledge out there, they would want, you know, to have designed the best, the most research-based, evidence-based program that they could have. Right. And so I think there's many ways to translate research to practice. Building products or tools is one of them. And so we also need to be thinking about product developers and programs out there, ed tech companies that are doing this and making sure they're getting the knowledge and also doing it. So that's one way to translate research to practice, is through a product, like incorporating it into a product. And we can talk about, you know, the decoding measure in a second, because that's something I did in a very small way, in a small scale. But then we can also talk about just accessing research and understanding. And those are the kind of four things, or sorry, it might be five or six, actually, that I talked about in my Reading League talk that you were at. And that is something I should say at the outset, though, and my thinking is changing on this. It's not, you know, 180 swings, but just kind of congealing in a certain era. I do not think it should be the teachers. I don't think they should be the ones going, searching out journals, trying to read it, trying to synthesize it. There needs to be a better system in place. It is not on their shoulders to be doing that. And I don't think that's reasonable, sustainable. In fact, I think we have pretty good systems, scalable systems in place for conducting and sort of disseminating research. If you think about the peer review process, which has been around for several hundred years, it's not perfect by any means. There's a lot of great articles on, you know, what's the future of the peer review process, but scientists, you know, have all agreed on it, but then we don't have the equivalent for translating that knowledge base that we have. And I think the best example that we have, and people might disagree, maybe there's a better one, but the one that I look to is the field of medicine. They're in the same boat, right? They have a lot of research and then they have to treat patients on a daily basis. And they have two key components that I see that education is missing. First, they have training. So they have really intensive training in med school in understanding research and its limitations. And then they have ongoing systems, so commercial apps. And I talked about this as well in the Reading League, things like UpToDate, to disseminate new research as it comes out. So this intensive training plus the system of updating doctors to make sure they have the best evidence-based information. Mm-hmm. Now, in the field of education, we don't even have the first part. We know there's a recent report that came out that showed that, I think, on the syllabi of, you know, several, you know, many different teacher prep programs were failing. They weren't teaching teachers what they needed to know. And then we have no sort of system to update teachers once they've left their teacher prep program.
Right.
So I don't know. I think that's why I say it's going pretty badly. I think there's pockets. I think that it's cool. Social media is great. I see researchers, you know, posting their papers on there, which is nice that they're, you know, they feel they have a voice, but that's not systematic, right? It's up to them whether they want to post or not. And it's also not synthesizing the full research. It's just one paper.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm guilty of this too. The reading research recap is great for alerting people, but it's by no means what should be like a perfect system in my mind.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. You just offered so many thoughts and I didn't have my notebook today. So I have like an index card, which I think will work perfectly.
Yeah, that works.
Okay. So a lot of thoughts I have here. First, when you talked about accessing research and product design, I had this thought and training, you said, with the medical model. I don't know if you're aware of the article that Emily Solari had penned in 2020. I talk about it all the time on the podcast, in my talks that I give. It was on the 74 where she called for pulling multiple levers in the system of education simultaneous levers to translating research to practice, from teacher prep programs to policies to district leaders. Okay. To community groups, all of these, she had like maybe a number of like five or six. And the one thing actually that I would add perhaps to that is this room for, as you said, product design and innovation. Because when you're in some of the things, at least I have been noticing in policy, right, is you have a great policy. I think someone on the podcast, maybe it was Kristen Winnett, talked about a policy is only so good as the tools that it's being used to implement it, right? Yeah. And in drawing on a lot of work that I've done or I've seen in research in change, actually, in a paper I just read about reading reform, I think it was Cohen, and I'll have it on the Read podcast, Cohen hit a co-author in 2017, that one of the aspects of successful reading reform was providing the tools and resources to actually implement the reform, right? Yeah. Doesn't seem that, you know, overwhelmingly brilliant. I mean, it is brilliant, right? But it seems like intuitive, right? That you should provide the tools and resources.
Right.
And so when you talked about product design, I want to see how you bridge product design and access to research. And so I want to draw back on your work on Element O and Metametrics. And I think that was an important case study in innovation and how we facilitate research to practice. So can you walk us through the process or the components that you considered to ensuring that research was ultimately translating in a way that research that educators understood and ultimately benefited their practice?
Sure. And I can't speak broadly about how it should be done, because I just know I can speak to what happened and what I've learned. And it's a fun kind of case study for me to talk about, because I did learn so much throughout the process. And so it started with this kernel of an idea in my doctoral program. You know, my advisor, Lori Cutting, she had this idea. It's like, we have all these great measures or formulas for text that's more complex, and even lexiles, right? Market leaders, grades 3 through 8. But what about these early grades, K through 2? What do we have for decodability? We know it's so important for kids to have that practice in the right text early on. And she had young sons at the time. And I was like, that sounds really interesting. That's a project I'd love to work on. And so what we did, and what's really cool, you talk about, you know, how do we make sure there's research behind it? Well, we did a large lit review, and we'd known about, you know, decoding so important and phonics from the research, but also we had data from her lab to test out or validate these different models or formulas we were coming up with. And so that was a really key part. It's like, we could come up with different variables in this decoding measure, but for based on theory, right? So you scan the literature, you do your lit review, and theoretically, you know, the length of the word, it should be important, right? So, okay, let's put that in. Let's check it out. Does it actually predict students' oral reading errors and what types of errors they're making? And so through that process of theory and then refining it using data, you come up with a model that's, you know, pretty powerful, but still has components that make sense. And I think that's really important because if you don't understand what's going in the model and you can't change that, then it's not going to be useful, right? Mm-hmm. So all these models, there's a great quote by a statistician, I think his name is George Box, that goes, all models are wrong, but some are useful. And all models are wrong because they're simplifications of reality, right? You're never going to have every variable that's important for decoding for every child in your model. So right. You simplify it to the most important ones. But what makes it useful for a product is really important. And there's more on that because so we came up with these models. Vanderbilt filed a patent. And years later, you know, I was out of Vanderbilt by that time, but we fought for it. You know, most they get rejected on all these different grounds and you fight slowly and you overcome each one of them. And this is an exciting process. But basically, what we developed wasn't ultimately what turned into Lexile Find a Decodable Book. And so after we'd gotten some initial leads from some pretty large educational companies, but those deals never went through for various reasons. And I'm not privy to all the details, but I was like, we're getting interest. Why don't I see what I can do with this? And so I was encouraged through the technology transfer office to take an entrepreneurship course, my like second to last year in my doc program. And I did. And at first I hated it. I actually quit midway and then came back after around Christmas break. I was like, this is so foreign, so difficult.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to give up. But then when I stuck it out after the final presentation, I was like, and the course was centered on how do you take research and write like an SBIR grant or STTR grant, which is known as like the government seed fund, mm-hmm. and translate research into a product. And so after our final presentations, I remember thinking like, I can't stop thinking about this. This is the most exciting thing that's kind of ever happened. And I was like, I could go into academia or I could take this risk and kind of start my own company. And I was like, I have to honor these feelings that I'm having that this is like so exciting. And so I decided not to go into academia and started LMNO when we moved to Raleigh. And going back to this idea of what we developed. So I spent those 2 years at LMNO just talking and building prototypes. So talking to so many teachers, product managers, parents, literacy tutors, decodable book publishers or authors, and just getting feedback. Like, is this useful? And it turns out it wasn't useful. They did not want that formula. They didn't want that single number. They wanted to know the letter sounds that were in the book. So I started developing some new prototypes and new measures that were matching students to text based on the letter sounds in the book that a teacher had taught. Mm-hmm. And so that's ultimately what Metametrics was interested in. And we built that out within their own capabilities at Metametrics to build Lexile Find a Decodable Book.
What an interesting story. And I think, again, speaks to another way, I guess, to innovate and to be entrepreneurial in education. The other piece I think that's really interesting in education is this role of technology and social media. There's a both and, there's an opportunity and a caution to that. And I'm curious to hear your thoughts. My thoughts are that I love the explosion of tech and social media. I think there's a lot of misinformation that exists there. You see more and more educators going to things like this to connect with researchers, more researchers doing it to provide an avenue to share their work. How do we be more, I guess, first, what is your thoughts on that? And second of all, in responding to my question, how do we be more educated consumers in some of the information that's out there?
Yeah, those are great questions. So I don't have brilliant insights on this. These are kind of I can riff on this for a little bit, but I think it's great when educators and researchers are connecting on social media. I think that's wonderful. I don't think, you know, I think we need to see what we can learn from social media. And there's a lot of things we can learn, which is that you know, 10 years ago, people would have thought, like, can we learn things about research from social media? Like, can you get information even that way? And I think people would have said no. But now we're seeing, yes, it's a very viable way. And a lot of teachers are getting their information from TikTok, short form video content that's super engaging. So I think those are things that we can take. We need to learn from that, you know, as researchers or as disseminators of information, if you want, going back to that interface of how should we engage with research? Well, let's make it appealing, engaging, short form. No one wants to read the paper, but is there a way to make it have a better interface? So I think social media has shown us how most people wants to engage with information, whether that's good or bad. So now I think we need to think about how do we make it a better system for a more cohesive system for disseminating research, what we know and what we don't know. So it's not on the individual researcher, you know, who's perhaps a social media savvy, right? And gets a lot of their papers out there. Whereas there's one who has these golden papers that I see that are like have such great practical classroom implications that just aren't getting out there.
Right.
So just making it more cohesive, I think, is important. And then I forgot your second question.
Oh, yeah. So I love how you talked about that. And I agree in terms of providing access to researchers, but in terms of the misinformation, so people, there's great information out there in terms of you can share papers and have researchers connect and provide insights based on maybe the papers that they've published, right? And there, I mean, I had to delete TikTok off my phone because I was like, this is affecting my mental health.
I just added it back.
I'm like, I don't know.
To learn though, for learning purposes.
Totally. Yeah, totally. Maybe you can redo the algorithm. But for things like other social media platforms or YouTube Shorts, for example, how do you judge whether it's not correct, right? Like,
is such an important question. And there's levels of, there's shades of gray with information in science, and this science is so nuanced. And I have seen two experts on a certain area or topic, you know, say slightly different things. And these are people who've published, you know, 20, 30 first author papers in stellar journals on this topic. So even then, is that misinformation or is it just super like nuanced? So I think there's clear stuff that's wrong. But then when you delve into, and Steve Dykstra at the Reading League gave a wonderful talk. I don't know if you went to his where he shows the, what's it called? The target, but the bullseye. And is it something like systematic intensive phonics instruction, direct systematic explicit phonics instruction? Like that's in the center of the, like 99% of researchers would agree with that, right? But then other stuff, how strong is the evidence? And I think different researchers would place different things in different areas. And so that's particularly hard to convey in something through social media, right? The levels of, you know, how off is this or how incorrect is this? And I don't think we have a great solution that goes to, I think we need to have great systems, like I said, for conducting and publishing science. But then when it comes to translation and the practical application, we don't have that like consensus meter yet. So it's something to think about.
Yeah, I love that. That's a really good point. So Dr. Saha, you have offered so much about how educators can be much more knowledgeable consumers of research. And we, in this last clip, we talked about social media, the benefits, the cautions of it. For me, sometimes I feel like maybe I'm a little too cautious about social media, but I do see the opportunities of it. I mean, I think I'm an example of someone who leveraged when it was Twitter back in the day of being able to actually directly talk to researchers. And I love when researchers might offer commentary or disseminate papers. But sometimes the reason why I say it's caution is because there's so many nuances of practices that can't be summarized in like a 60-second YouTube short, for example. Although maybe if you had a series, maybe that would be good. But I think what I'm getting to is my question is, there is such a value in sharing information directly through things like social media, newsletters, and things like that. But I see this sometimes as like a window or a spark, right? And so when teachers see something and they say, oh, I want to learn more about that, what are those resources or directions they can take to be more proactive consumers of this research and taking this information and using it in their classroom?
Yeah, it's a great question. And there's so much to unpack within it. I should start out by kind of laying this groundwork that I don't think we have fantastic resources yet. I think we can get there, but I don't think there's one, you know, oh, I would point teachers to this or to that. I think journal articles at this point, like that is too much to ask teachers to go and find the original research and be able to understand and consume that. It's just too much. There are some good practitioner journals. So the Reading Teacher is the one that comes to mind. There's a few other ones that are geared towards practitioners. And what they do is they kind of synthesize the research, or they have viewpoint articles where they will, you know, take research, their own sort of a group of authors or researchers will synthesize the research in terms of classroom, practical classroom applications. So those are good. The Reading Week has a great journal as well. I think it comes out 3 times a year and I subscribe to that. So I read those again that translate the research. I wish there were more articles and, you know, resources that kind of gave a status update across, you know, kind of takes like the National Reading Panel and does like an update on these key hot topics across those pillars, or maybe across, you know, 10 to 15 different subjects, maybe not as, you know, as condensed as the 5 that they go through, and just say, here's what came out this year. You know, here's what we still don't know. Here's what we're researching, just to give that sort of annual, you know, like level the playing field of here's what we know, what we don't know. I think that would be an amazing resource. I don't know why that hasn't been done, you know, organized by topic, just so we can see, you know, the main papers that have come out on it, and especially focusing on meta-analyses or systematic literature reviews and getting to those specific classroom sort of practical implications. How do we do that? And that's very tricky because going on a little bit of a tangent here, but there's no standardized way of presenting the results in a paper and what that means for the classroom. The vagueness, the ambiguity in language, you know, is on the one hand a pro, it's a plus, but it's also a con when it comes to what exactly does this mean? Because if there's ambiguity in how we translate to the classroom, that's going to be a problem. Another issue is that researchers, when they're writing that sort of classroom implications part, many researchers haven't been teachers. Many have, but many also have not. So maybe this is something like it's a burden or an onus that the publishers take on. And maybe they have researchers sit down with teachers and have them ask questions, be like, can I do this based on these results? Can I do this? Or are you suggesting this in my classroom? Something like that, some sort of back and forth in the classroom implications part, instead of just the one-sided researcher saying this might be possible. But again, back to the main point, we don't have like a great system or one resource.
I love that. Actually, my eyes lit up because I was like, oh my gosh, what a great way. Again, this entrepreneurial look of saying, okay, you know, I think that there's a great system, for example, of fidelity of implementation, right? I remember when I was doing my doctorate work, I had a list of questions to think about, right? And frameworks like theories of treatments and logic models to think through that and to communicate that. But we almost need some sort of like logic model or theory of treatment for then translation. And and I guess maybe I'm thinking about my bias as a teacher because I already have that classroom experience. So maybe I have those two hats, right? But as a researcher, maybe there needs to be something a little more explicit, like you said, of like, okay, here's the logic model. Here's how it might work. And here's maybe what we don't know. Is that what you're sort of getting at?
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you say like a logic model, that's similar to what I'm saying, like a system. We don't have a systematic way of approaching the classroom implications part. It's all just kind of like the Wild West out there in terms of that. We have systems for getting grants, conducting research, IRB approval for the whole part of like the research part. But then when it comes to this translation of knowledge after you've left, you know, your training program, how do we keep teachers updated, right? And not just, and I'm not talking about the end research part where you're in a classroom and like fidelity of implementation, right? I'm talking about like, how do we take new knowledge maybe that they weren't part of that study, and we don't have a great system for that. Yeah, exactly. So
yeah. I like that. And you talked about a couple of papers. The one we had, you and I had spoken about offline was the 2021 Petcher and colleagues paper, How the Science of Reading Informs the 21st Century Education. I thought that was one example. Yeah. Fantastic, right? Because they outlined so much of what we know and further questions. Like, you know, I think they were one of the first papers I read to think, oh, right, like, what is it that we need to explore more about comprehension, for example? And it sort of led me down that path of an FCRR when they're doing a lot of work of like whole child work, like Petcher, Dr. Petcher is doing. And I can keep going down a tangent, but I'll stop there. But I think that's one example where we see them synthesizing, right?
Yeah, that is fantastic. Like, take that model. I don't want to put more on their plate, but what if they did that every year and maybe expanded the topics and we got like a status update on, you know, what do we know? What do we not know? I think that would be fantastic.
Yeah.
So they should start a journal. They should start a journal and just have like an update, a synthesis, an annual review of what we know, what we don't know.
Well, I think also that speaks to Reading Research Recap, right? And some of the work that you've been doing and taking a certain number of studies and saying, you know, here are the implications. Here's where, you know, here where you can go in your classroom and here's what I'm interested in. And is that sort of the, that was sort of like your inspiration.
Exactly. It was. And what I do, though, that I think is slightly different than what we were just talking about is I pick a paper that come, you know, I'm dependent on what comes out. Whereas I think they should do that even if no cool papers come out, right?
Like,
it's a whole, it's cumulative and it's comprehensive, I think is more the word I'm talking about. Whereas mine, it's just like focusing on that one. And if there's no interesting, great papers on comprehension, then I won't cover it. But they, I think, or whoever does take on that, you know, annual review should still say, okay, there wasn't anything, you know, interesting or new here. And that's important. Right. So yeah, covering both
I love that. So I think you did touch on cumulative and structuring research, that it's cumulative, that it's comprehensive. How do you also see that as explaining anomalies, or are there other methods that we could do to say, hey, like this worked for most kids, this might not work for this certain subset of the population?
Yeah. And so this is where science gets so nuanced and complex. And I think we can do a better job of incorporating single case research design. And the name's a little bit misleading because single case doesn't necessarily mean on one single person. You can have, you know, 5 to 10 in one study, and you can also, you know, include more if you want. You can expand the study. But the focus is on looking at individual variation. And so I'm a big proponent, I've talked about this in the Reading Research Recap and elsewhere as well, of combining this like idea of group design with single case research design and seeing how we can really get at what works for whom and when. Like, I think we're finally moving to this idea of, you know, personal, like data techniques and, you know, compute power. Like, we can finally analyze this data, you know, large quantities of data within a person across time. And I think, you know, we might be able to get, especially also, you know, I'm going on tangent now with like game up, like apps and games, educational ed tech that can collect this sort of nuanced data and maybe A/B test within a person and see, you know, all right, this student needs these explicit decoding rules, whereas this one's kind of, you know, picking up on the statistical regularities a little bit more quickly without that. And the rules just kind of overwhelm them in a way. You know, I feel like we could figure out by individual eventually, maybe this is a pipe dream, but I think down the road we can get there. Right now, I think it's hard because most studies are group design. And we seem to also place a lot of weight on group design studies and then meta-analyses of those group design studies. And when you're doing a meta-analysis, it's like even one layer removed from that data, from those, because the population are studies at that point, not individuals. So to figure out if something's applicable to your classroom as a teacher, you want to find that meta-analysis, look at the individual studies, and then go back and check the populations of those and make sure they're kind of similar to your students. Look at the demographic information, you know, and just check, because that's, you know, not everything works for all these, for every student, right? There's going to be variation. And I think, I mean, I'm a mom, and I think parents or anyone who's worked with young kids knows this, like kids are so different. Siblings are even different. So to figure out and optimize that learning is going to be important. And that's also something, sorry, talking a lot here. You're pretty good at this.
Good.
With like AI tutors now and like individualization and figuring out, I'm seeing a lot of cool stuff that can happen. So optimistic in this area.
I think this even just, you made an important point, is that recognizing that all that kids are different, right? And that, remember when I was teaching, I did a fifth grade class and they all had either some sort of language-based learning disability or were diagnosed with dyslexia. And their decoding needs were pretty similar, but the language needs and the processing and the working memory needs were so diverse that it took, you know, at the baseline, this like super metacognitive awareness of student A needing certain, even just like a certain amount of wait time versus student B may have needed the same amount of wait time, but it was because student B just wanted to blurt out everything in their mind without, you know, taking the time to, for them to process versus student A actually like having really low really high needs in processing time, right? They had a really low processing speed.
Teachers see this all the time and that's so difficult. Can you imagine classroom management with like those different students? It's so hard, and making sure that they all get the opportunities to respond. So I definitely think this is an area where technology can help out too.
Yeah, I love those points. And I think I want to circle back when we talked about translating research to practice and not putting the onus on teachers. And earlier in the episode, I'd mentioned Emily Solari's 74 million article, the 2020 article, where she talks about pushing these multiple levers. And I think that's so pertinent as I think about policy change that is enacted, right? I mean, recently, I think it was December or early January, the Governor Hochul signed the Dyslexia Task Force bill. And we're seeing a lot of literacy bills being pushed out across the country. And so where I'm going with that is that multiple levers need to be pushed and that there needs to be this comprehensive systems change from research to policy. It's one that we think a lot about in professional development at the WI, right? Of taking research, like practices that are grounded in research and making them effective, efficient, and feasible. So I think my question for you is, as a researcher, what are you looking for from those different levels, from policy, from even district leaders, from teacher prep or PD programs, that they could be more effective in ensuring that the onus isn't on teachers to translate and apply it to their classrooms?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's a great point to bring up. And I'm going to kind of bow out of this question a little bit because I don't know if I am qualified enough to actually speak at the level of systems change. I don't have direct experience in it. However, I would say I just came across a really fascinating paper. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to feature it actually, I think in a couple months here for the Reading Research Recap, about a theory of professional development. You know, what makes one professional development program more effective than another? And that's what these researchers, you know, they put forward a theory. I can't repeat it because I haven't read it yet. I don't know what it is. And then they test it and they look at data and see, you know, which ones were more effective. Because I definitely think we need that. Not all PD is created equal. And if you are a district or like an admin, right, you don't want just any PD. You want evidence of effectiveness, just like you would for a program that you use for your students. And so what makes something more effective versus not, I think, is something we need to also like codify, systematize, and make it sort of transparent. It's definitely necessary. I think we're in the beginning stages of that. That's why my eyes lit up when I saw that paper. It's like, this is what we need. Everyone is putting out PD right now. It's so hot, especially given the uptake of letters. But like, what, you know, is that translating to student gains? And I think in some papers, we're starting to see that. It's a stretch, right, to make sure and to expect that within 1 year of like training teachers, which are the studies I've seen take place in a year. But we are seeing evidence that it does help, you know, improve student outcomes. So which variables or which components of that PD especially are effective? So kind of a non-answer, but I think we'll get there. I do have this interesting tangent that I want to share about implementation fidelity, which I thought was great. And I might have to dig up a paper and come back to you on this. But when I was in my maybe first or second year at my doc program at Vanderbilt, Doug Fuchs, so big name, big researcher in the field with RTI, response to intervention and MTSS, he gave this, you know, just kind of a local, you know, on campus talk about implementation fidelity. And I believe it was a study he was involved in. So he starts his talk talking about Starbucks, about how they ran a study about whether they should give these sort of like top down from corporate headquarter rules or for store design. I think it was design or something about processes or design of the stores, or should they let them adapt them to local needs? And they found out that when they were adapting them to local needs, like the stores were kind of in charge of themselves rather than this top down, it was actually better. Like I'm assuming the outcome measure was like profits or some like satisfaction. But then he segued into his data on this where they were looking at, you know, I think it was their PALS program. Like when you implement it, do teachers have to be completely scripted in order to have the best student outcomes? Or is there some sort of, can you give leeway in certain areas, right? There's certain things we want to cover as teachers we know are super important, right? Explicit decoding and phonics is important to teach. But in certain areas, if we give teachers that agency, and I believe that was the condition that was better. So I need to dig up this research, but I found that so interesting because it's like teachers just don't want completely scripted stuff. You know, if there's a way that they can infuse their own age, they know their students the best. So if they can adapt that curriculum in a way in certain areas, maybe that study sticks with me. It's just so fascinating. And I think we're also seeing that model across different areas, like our local Barnes and Nobles now completely redid it. And there's a lot more local store autonomy. It is 100 times better. Even my husband was saying he feels guilty buying books on Amazon now, because when you go into the store, it's such a wonderful experience. So I just think it's something interesting to keep in mind with classrooms too and teacher autonomy.
Yeah. Oh, I love when you brought that in. Reminded of a paper I'd written. Now I have to not read. I didn't write it. I read about the importance of a teacher agency and PD in translating student outcomes. I think the author said something like PD fails when it fails to address teacher agency. But I think loosely related to your point, right, is that, you know, it's not like the teacher's not going to take this package program and adopt it like verbatim, right? And that because that teacher is an expert in the room, right? You're giving them the tools to do that, but, you know, they know their students best, right? And there's also this so many other variables like relational aspects and trust, right? Like you can't have someone delivering it robotically when you have humans in front of you and a human delivery.
Yeah. So more testing, I think, in that area of like, where can we allow for more agency or not? And it brings up also this point of like, you know, Fountas and Pinnell and some of those programs that were shown not to be evidence-based or effective, but they made the teacher feel, you know, valued, powerful, that autonomous, and they had that own sense of agency. So we need obviously evidence-based, but also you can't forget that human aspect. So. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I'm like, but my eyes, my brain is just buzzing with so many things. Like, I love how you offered some implications for social media, for technology, or even this aspect of human agency. There's so many things that I just feel like I need to run with and like learn more about. Final points. I always like to add with, or I guess final question is, what are your hopes for the future? And I think I like to put out calls into the, not only the Reed universe, but in the education universe at large about where we see the future of education and translation of research and education going. So can you leave us with a few hopes or calls for the future on this, other than what you've already offered, on what the translation of research and practice should be? What should we be focusing on, especially in this new year?
Yeah. Well, I think a lot of the things, my hopes are that we address some of the things we talked about, right? So I know that good work's being done at getting teacher credentialing programs to incorporate more evidence-based practices and teach teachers. So like that's the one part in that sort of medical model. We know that doctors have that extensive training. But the part that's really exciting is my hope is that there will be scalable, systematic, consensus building way of translating research practice. So this implementation science, I hope that we at least can solve some of those problems, maybe not all in the next, you know, like 3 to 5 years. I mean, these are not intractable problems. Like we know we can get information out there, but then there's, you know, it'll take work and effort, but I'm sure we can get researchers to at least even, you know, do that bullseye thing. Like, where would you place this fact, right? A teacher has this question. Is this evidence enough to support it? And just, you know, Mark, that's very simple technology we can use. It's just, you know, corralling all the enough researchers to kind of get a feeling on this. But we can make that scalable as well. But I do think it's important that we start having more teacher voices in the research that gets done. Mm-hmm. So something that I like to see on LinkedIn, you know, when people put up that like open to work, well, I think that's really cool because it's like, you know, I wonder if we can't create something like that, like a platform where there's researchers and teachers and, you know, teachers could say like, open, because I know a problem having been in research is fostering those university and school relationships and getting in classrooms can be really intimidating for researchers. Mm-hmm. So if there's teachers who are like willing to, you know, like, look, we'll participate in the research. Here's a question I have. Can we focus on this question and try and explore it? Just making better bridges for making that easier, making it having less friction in that sort of back and forth. So things like that.
Yeah. Oh, I love that. That's so good. As I don't know if you know this, but Windward is one of two schools working with Yale right now. Nice. We have EEG in-school neuroscience lab. And so as a teacher,
that's amazing.
It is so empowering to see, you know, that as a teacher, I can be a designer of my student instruction, right? Because this is being validated by the research, and that to participate and talk with researchers has been such a unique opportunity that I never thought I'd be able to get. And so I know that there's a number of universities, FCRR and Vanderbilt and others that are MGH Institute does a lot of work with that. So I like that call because I think there's much more opportunity for that.
Yeah. Imagine if we can get like all universities that have like that school, you know, there's just a lot more stuff that can be done. Yeah, I know there are. Vanderbilt did have like a lab school, I think, on site too.
Yeah.
But also Metro Nashville. There were some researchers that were better than others at getting in the schools too. So,
Right. But
I'm really, one of the things with why I love UpToDate is that the doctor who he founded it on this sort of core principle of what are the clinical questions that doctors have. He didn't start with like, what's the research out there? He's like, what are the questions that they have to answer on a daily basis? And like, that's what I think we need to focus on. Like, what are these burning questions that teachers have? Then let's examine the research, right? Let's not just start and just, you know, let's synthesize what we have out there. So I think it's really important that we start paying attention to and validating teachers' questions and needs and concerns.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you. You provided so many resources that we're going to link on the Read Podcast website. Oh. But where can we find you and where can we learn more about you for those teachers that have questions for you?
Sure. So the Reading Research Recap is great through Metametrics. And I can link, give you all that information too, so people can sign up through the Lexile Hub. But I think on LinkedIn, I don't post a lot. I do a lot of reposting or liking of things. But if they want to follow me, they can definitely message me, connect on LinkedIn, and I can give you my email too. They can email. I, you know, try my best to respond quickly to all the emails I get. And yeah, that's pretty much the only social media I do. I'm not on Twitter. I kind of stealth mode, just like survey what's out there, but I haven't engaged a lot. I probably should, but.
Well, so you talked about LinkedIn and I think at least you're accessible. So I think that's such
a. Yeah. I'm on LinkedIn.
Yeah, that's great. Well, Dr. Nina Saha, thank you so much for being on the Read Podcast.
Oh, the pleasure's mine. Thank you for having me. This has been fun.
Of course. It was so engaging and you spawned so many further areas of curiosity for me that I'm so eager to dive into. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you, you too. And thank you all for listening to this episode of the Read Podcast. You can learn more about our top Read bookmarks at readpodcast.org or by visiting the Windward School's website, windwardschool.org/WI, the Windward Institute for more information. You can also link back to all of our past episodes with our expert Read guests, as well as following us on social media, which include X, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and LinkedIn. I'm on LinkedIn as well. And that is it. We have a lot more information coming for you from the Windward Institute this year in 2024. And so we look forward to connecting with you. And Dr. Saha, at the end of the podcast, we always say until next time, readers. And I've been asking the guests to say it as the final close off because it's a lot of fun for you to have the final word. So would you like to do our final send off?
Sure. Until next time, readers.
Thank you so much.